Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Adelsky, with my co-host, Dr. Carl. And today, we got Dr. Alexandra Soa, the author of the brand new book, The Ozempic Revolution. Here today, we're just going to go over parts of her book and promote it. We're going to shill the book so everybody can go out. It's flying off the bookshelves right now like hotcakes.
Yeah.
I've heard. She was on Good Morning America talking about it. Patients of mine have gotten it and have been enjoying it. So welcome to the show, Dr.
Soa. Thanks, guys. I loved hearing that intro. I dance along and I listen to you on the regular. So fun
yes.
to be part of it.
Perfect.
Awesome.
So what's the origin story?
Well,
I
want to hear more about your background.
Well, she's internal medicine.
I know, where did you go to school? Where did you do internal medicine residency?
Okay, super quick. Undergrad, Johns Hopkins. My dad's a hand surgeon, so I always had being a doctor in my purview, but I really was interested in public health and prevention. So my undergrad degree is actually in public health. Worked at the World Health Organization briefly in college, and I really liked the idea of affecting change on a mass scale. But when it came to really choosing a career path, I still wanted to work with the individual. So I think in my bones, prevention was always my path, and I knew it. I just didn't know how it was going to come to be. So I went to NYU School of Medicine. I did internal medicine residency there also. I chose internal medicine because I wanted to kind of keep it broad. I knew I was not my surgeon like my dad, and I wanted to learn really about the whole body. I became pretty disillusioned, I'd say, during my training when all of our education was end of disease management care.
When were you in residency
at NYU? When was I in residency? This is a
not that I want to expose age, but
2011, 2014. Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, same as me.
Yeah.
And I graduated from internal medicine in 2011 from my residency in the Navy. And then did obesity medicine the first year that was a thing in 2012 before going to endocrine fellowship. And then Spencer was in family practice residency the same time you were there.
Yeah, 2011 to 2014.
Yeah.
So you might not have had as extreme. All of my education was hospital-based. And it was just when we were in the clinic, it was just so weird. A disease that was so far advanced. And we knew that weight loss would help, but we didn't have any good tools.
Yeah, it was all kind of being really published around those years because, you were in med school then and I was in residency and Spencer and I were really into all the new stuff being published, you know, with the phenermine, the topiramate, the naltrexone, bupropion back then. And of course, we can talk about the history of the GLPs as I was preparing for endocrine, we had a lot of exenatide and then liraglutide, Victoza, and then Saxenda, et cetera, all in that time frame. So that's okay. That gives me a good background.
It exploded. Okay, I'll blow your mind a little bit. So when I was in residency and saying I want to do preventive medicine, my dad goes, you know, I think I have a med school buddy who's really doing this too. Well, his med school buddy, it was Dr. Lou Aroney.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there was his, that's amazing. So for those out there, he's been certainly a leader in the field. One of those people publishing those studies back when we were med students and going to the conferences and getting involved early on. Yeah.
One of my medical assistants is his niece or,
Well, he's amazing, and he gets a shout out in the acknowledgments of my book because he is the one who introduced me to this field and, became quickly obsessed. There was nothing else I could do.
Yeah.
Just had to pursue this. And so became board certified shortly after my internal medicine residency. And I got a chance to study with some really interesting people around the country, including Eric Westman down at Duke, learning about nutrition.
Yeah,
that's why you're a low carb shill. Is that right?
Yeah, we're gonna tease you about that a little bit. But Westman was our buddy when that was our first conference we went to before
2010 or 2009.
I was still in residency. So it was like 2010, probably.
Yeah.
You were, Spencer was a student, and we hung out with Westman and all his buddies. And so we're friends with Westman too. And
You know, he's like done incredible work in the field. And I think we've moved away from some of it because really when you get out into practice, it doesn't work long term, what I found. But I do, I do enjoy a low carb way of eating generally, not keto. I learned a lot from him, and really the concept of no one was teaching nutrition at that time. So we were learning a lot about meds, and that was awesome. But there was a big hole, I thought, in even obesity medicine management and care, which was how do you eat? So really dove into that and really just read everything I could and then started putting it into practice with my patients and learning from others who had been doing it, you know, much longer and better than me. So that's my background. I launched a private practice in New York City on my own in 2018. And we were all obesity medicine. It was not just here's a prescription and move along. It was very, very holistic and it was awesome. We started setting up our practice to be hybrid even before the pandemic. And then as soon as the pandemic hit, we went fully online and then grew into about 13 states at this point. In my practice, I had the opportunity to play around with interesting care models that allowed me to teach. I really felt like all of my patients they didn't need it. I felt like they were entitled to the information and to know why we were doing certain things. Yeah. And in order to be a successful long-term weight management patient, you really had to know. You got to go to like a mini med school.
I agree. I'm actually a big fan of that. I was just talking to I'm an old mentor of mine who is a real type 1 diabetes guru. And we were talking about how to, you know, talk to people about why do they need these goals, these glycemic goals? And I said, I really think just educating them almost the same way we get educated for that. And then, of course, what you're talking about, just obesity in the bigger picture. I think it's very important. I love that.
I think we don't give patients enough credit. And so I really left behind kind of the academic nature of like, because I say so. And, you know, I think everything that we do has to be an informed discussion. And our field really, really embraces that, right? So I think that I found the right fit and I was able to practice in this way. So in my practice, I developed what I call the So Well method. And I had patients come to me. We had group education on Zoom weekly where I moved them through the foundational habits in the order in which I had found that they worked the best. Not doing everything at once, moving slowly through it, habit stacking, learning how to prepare, how to eat, how to think, how to move. And with the explosion of GLP-1s everywhere and me seeing it kind of doled out what I felt inappropriately and people wanting a solution and it being such a miracle, but feeling so unwell and out of control in the process, I was like, I got to write this book. So that was how this book came to be.
Nice. I really wanted to learn more about, because, you know, of course, we didn't have time to like reread, but, you know, went through it the best we could. And, you know, really, it seems like the biggest premise to me is what you call your So Well method. Now, I don't think, because I tried to find it, I don't think you've necessarily published it in like a peer-reviewed type scientific journal, but obviously you have adapted things that are published that people are doing and they're in different guidelines and whatnot, but sort of adapted it and personalized it for you and what you've experienced with your patients. And that's, to me, what I think a lot of people can get out of the book. Just because it's a supportive way to do it. So tell us about how you sort of came up with that and how that came about.
Everything I do is evidence-based. I think sometimes you adapt the evidence to meet people where they are and to lead kind of heart forward, right? Which isn't the most sciencey thing to say, but this is an emotional field. What I did was kind of just find the rhythm that I found worked with human beings and taking what the evidence says to be true. And we know that that good obesity care, good weight care deserves a multidisciplinary team, right? In practice, that can be very, very hard to achieve. So I kind of created that team through action that my patients could take and kind of take with them day through day. And just kind of wash, rinse, repeat, do it again, iterate on it, make it even better for my patients. And then they come, you know, to come out the other side, kind of true believers in believing about the things that we've usually just told people, kind of, you got to do it, but then it's hard to implement, right? Like stepping on the scale, being emotionally neutral about stepping on the scale, eating whole foods, prioritizing protein, strength training. If you tell people, if you give someone a handout at the start of a visit with all these lovely things that we know to be true, it's going to be very, very hard to actually get most patients to do this. And so that's what kind of the methodology is, like, let's move through it. And that's what I teach in the book and kind of outline it in that same fashion. Because these meds are amazing, but we have to do work beyond it to achieve true health.
But you weren't doing this. I mean, so yeah, obviously we've had these medications since I was a med student. Byetta was approved in
2005,
you know, and then it was Victoza and then Saxenda for you know, diabetes and weight loss, respectively. And then later on, then it was, you know, Ozempic was approved for type 2 diabetes in 2017. But what you're really talking about is more of, it's almost like intuitive lifestyle, baby steps, piecemeal or something, you know, kind of,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, I think what I say in the book
and it was before these meds. I mean,
yeah. So I've always, I've always used GLP-1 medications. They've become much more efficacious and easy to tolerate, and patients are more willing to embrace them now than they were 10 years ago. I remember it being actually a struggle to convince patients to go on Saxenda.
Really?
That's
interesting to me, but you know, maybe it's just different
patient
populations. It was
really covered back then. It was like $800 and 7 to 8% total body weight loss. It's not a good
drug. Yeah, and I could get probably better with the oral agents. So
yeah.
So I had developed this independent of GLP-1s, have now made it really particular to GLP-1s. But what I even say in the book is some of these techniques will feel familiar to people, but GLP-1s allow them to finally have the mental bandwidth to implement the things that they were beating themselves up not doing for all those years, right?
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, so other medications, and you do, you know, briefly mention them, phenermine topiramate, brand name of Qsymia, was approved in 2012. Right. Then a little bit of time after that, then came naltrexone, bupropion, Contrave. We don't need to talk about lorcaserin taken off the market. Yeah. But anyways, I mean, presumably,
I like
especially,
one,
yeah, it, well, it, yeah, we, that's a whole different debate as to why they took that off. But you were, I'm certainly using those and probably off-label different combinations the cheaper versions back then for the obesity management. But were you also doing a lot of type 2 diabetes? I guess that's why, you know, I had so much, you know, like, but you did internal medicine. So you were probably doing a ton of obesity with type 2 diabetes. So you're probably doing a ton of Byetta, Victoza, and then later on some of the other ones. So like I had a ton of experience back then. I think Spencer, you had a lot of type 2 diabetes too, because either that or we were just such nerds. We talked about this all the time.
Indigent population. I don't know what it was at NYU, but indigent population, they covered sulfonylureas. Oh. And my attendings didn't ever use them. So I was the only one in residency basically using them when I could get insurance to cover it. And they were like, and I'm signing out to them. And they're like, I don't know what this is. I'm like, well, okay, you're not going to be of any help here. So I guess I'm going to figure this out myself.
Yeah. And of course, my situation was totally different. It was in the Navy, and we had a pretty progressive, academically advanced, you know, group of mentors too. So,
well, and you were sailing the 7 Z's.
Yeah, I mean, so we had coverage for type 2 diabetes for Byetta, for Victoza, and really, there are struggles here and there, but we got Victoza when it came out. We had Victoza, so I did a ton of.
But how was NYU though?
You know what, I will be honest. I'm trying to even remember back. I would say that I wasn't doing complicated obesity medicine care there, because it was a little hands-on. So we had to kind of follow the script.
Yeah, that's heard about
like that.
Yeah.
I didn't have to follow any
script.
Well, didn't you say
what the hell they were doing?
Well, but they also seemed to give you a hard time, whereas
a hard time about lifestyle.
They were like mentors. They were like all in. You know, in fact, some of I had one mentor who was the ICU doctor, who very smart, and it went out of his box all the time, said, hey, let's talk about obesity. And we were looking into the science together, and because he was seeing all the downstream effects, not just type 2 diabetes and heart disease and stuff, but he was seeing them dying in the ICU. And so he took me under the wing a lot. I was very lucky, I guess, compared to what I hear about from you guys.
I think so. I had a really strong exposure and a good exposure to bariatric surgery. Mm. And that was where the energy was funneled at NYU, which was great. But again, I'm not a surgeon, so what can I do here? And a lot of people don't want surgery. So it was an exciting time to be in the emerging fields. And I still love and really promote and support my bariatric surgery colleagues. And we should not be forgetting about that field.
Agreed.
Rates are going down.
We could do a whole podcast on that, how we need to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, I guess. But
so I think with the book too. So there are a lot of primary care doctors out there, and we all trained originally as primary care doctors. My brother specialized in the endocrine, so did a fellowship, but I still consider myself that base of primary care that then specialized further, but still do a lot of primary care within what I do. But like, imagine in the system. So you left the system, as did I. Mm-hmm. My brother is a martyr, so he's still in the system at the moment, but leaving soon, hopefully.
Well, I don't have any choice. I am, but I'll still be a martyr.
You'll be
that's
a martyr.
What I do.
But so you left the system because I think the system creates this terrible way of practice. So you're able to leave the system, but the book I think is probably a good place to start for primary care doctors who just don't have enough time and be like, hey, here's the medicine. I know it's good for you. Well, hopefully they do, but a lot of them still have weight stigma and biases.
And you mentioned that in the first part of your book.
It's a book that can help people, understand the drugs a little bit more. Without the doctors don't have enough time. Does that sound
absolutely right? I mean, that's why I wrote this, because our current system is broken, and I know most doctors would love to spend a lot more time with their patients but don't have the capacity. And also, we are so small. Our little specialty is so small, and there aren't that many people who specialize in this. And I think a lot of doctors and prescribers are trying to do their absolute best and say, hey, I hear about the evidence for these meds. Sure, here's a prescription. But along with it, I would hope that they would recommend the book, or they themselves might read it. So, I really go through, this isn't just a lifestyle book, right? We do talk about that because it's very important, but I go through the science. Why is weight loss so complicated? And then I go through the science of the studies and kind of looking at the differences between all types of the GLP-1 medications, talking about the myths, misconceptions, the contraindications, what you can expect. And then we move into kind of like how you need to eat, how you need to think, and knowing the part that I think is resonating the most with readers actually is the part of the book that talks about what you might feel at different parts of this journey. I know I've done this for so long, and I know you guys see the same patterns, but like patients will panic at the 10-pound down mark, and they'll say, there's no way this is going to keep working. There's something about 10 pounds that people had been able to do over and over and over again before, and it's very triggering because they feel like it's not going to continue. So we talk about the 10-pound panic, and then we talk about what happens when people start to notice your weight loss and start to question you and then put shame on you, or it appears to be a compliment, but really it's a veiled insult. Go through all of that. And I think that that is a part of the journey of GLP-1s that's kind of just underrepresented. People don't talk about how it's a complicated emotional journey.
Yeah. I noticed that a significant portion of your book does – I was going to actually ask you if you had any training or anything in like psychology, or if you had some help with it, because I was like, a lot of this is – the psychological aspects of, really beyond GLPs, really just obesity and medical support for it and all that stuff. And so I thought that was pretty good. And some of it is, maybe it's a lot of it's anecdotal, but it certainly is evidence-based, like you said.
I draw from the evidence-based of cognitive behavioral therapy. And while I do not have additional training beyond my medical education, I have become a student of how best to help my patients with it and really have learned from colleagues. And so what we model here is not something that is totally new. I didn't make it up. It's not woo. It really works. And I have just found that the structure of cognitive behavioral therapy is very, very effective for this journey. Many times in my personal practice, I need to refer out to therapists and to psychiatrists because at some point it might get far beyond complicated, you know, beyond the work that we can do together. But I think it's important because there is nothing worse than the self-sabotage that can sometimes creep in, or the negative self-talk, even with all of these huge gains in health that we can achieve through weight. We still have to work through some of the trauma that's carried from all the years of carrying excess weight.
Yeah, the internalized bias, et cetera.
I want to hear, so without giving the meat away of the book, what are your top three tips for people who are just starting the GLP-1 in terms of, could be side effects, psychological things, top three things. Let's get people excited about buying your book.
Yeah. Well, I think, there's just so much. Top three.
Top three. Let's hear it. Quick. Three. Just top three right away. What are the first things that come to mind?
So I put just got a review online, I thought it was so cute. The woman had been on GLP-1s for a while, and she said, I've never heard anyone else say this, but I think I've been doing nutrition wrong. And in my nutrition section, I have some simple goals. So you're going to hit protein at every meal, and you're going to eat it first for many reasons, but especially in the GLP-1 journey, making sure you get your protein in first will make sure you get adequate nutrition. And I actually, you might think this is crazy, but I actually give people permission to not eat all the leafy green vegetables right at the beginning of their journey.
No, we don't care.
We're meatheads. Although I do probably try to get people, no matter what they're doing, to eat their veggies first. But we're meathead shills. So
I agree, because if they're filling up on leaves,
exactly.
If they don't get enough protein, then that's a problem.
So we talk about that. So. How diet culture has leaned heavily on volume metrics.
Oh dear Lord,
that was my book falling. I had it open to a page I wanted to keep open.
I think the diet culture has really made people think that volumetrics and leafy green vegetables is the way to go. And I think that's resonating with a lot of people. They're like, oh, no one told me about any sort of nutrition. We don't count calories in my practice. We look at macronutrients and kind of, and that's really about it. So that's a top takeaway. I also think people need to be prepared. In the book, I have a downloadable shopping list of things you need to get at the pharmacy or the grocery store before you start this journey. A lot of the side effects can be mitigated with supplements and with targeted nutrition. You know, we've talked about this. I developed a whole other company that's just for GLP-1 users and their side effects. But constipation, diarrhea, let's get ahead of that before. If you're someone who suffers with constipation, we need to manage that before you even get on GLP-1. We need to be making sure you're getting in your fiber. You might need some other products. You might need prescription strength products, but a lot of side effects can be managed, right? And they should not be such a horrible experience that you can't continue on, right? We should be able to help you figure that out. I would say the third thing in my book is, I think the structure for cognitive behavioral therapy in a very easy way that will allow you to keep tabs on your brain and your mental health throughout this journey is very, very helpful.
Yeah. I actually think that was, again, my relative skim through it was, I thought that was something I kind of, going back to what I said earlier, I really was taken by the emphasis on the mental health aspect of it, the psychology of it. And I think that's hard for even those of us who have the advantage of having a multidisciplinary team. I might have dietitians, you know, I'm gonna have some exercise people. I know that, but I don't feel as, even though we've been talking about it since we were med students, about the cognitive behavioral therapy and the intuitive stuff, all these things. I think that might be my favorite part of the book, just for what that's worth. Because that's something it's hard for people to get.
Yeah.
Like we all probably always say we need a behavioralist in our clinic.
Yeah.
And I had it in the military a little bit, and then I had one when I first got out. But it's like, again, the broken system doesn't really support what we truly need for a multidisciplinary effort. So I think that's a pretty beneficial thing to have out there for people.
Thank you.
Very cool. Yeah. So, you know, when people start, like you said, the 10-pound panic, they're like, is this just going to be another false hope? So that's a good thing to talk about. The side effects definitely are a good thing. Those are the things where, like, hey, you're probably going to get nausea. try to follow these, but you'll learn quickly if you try to eat a bunch of pizza or something heavy. They learn it pretty quickly, and it's a miserable experience.
I also, we have small memories. All of us do, like, very poor 24-hour recall. I do tell people to write things down, and not just for tracking their food, but like their symptoms. Like, how do you feel? So that they remember, and they're like, oh, yeah. Shouldn't eat that.
Yeah. You know where else that really helps play a role? So many different people have different food intolerances. And, they go and they pay for $1 million like allergy tests. But it turns out different people have different food intolerances. And, we do elimination diets and all this stuff. Man, it's amazing how much they can learn with just how they feel logging their food. So that's helpful.
Very cool. All right. So there's only one part we wanted to give you crap about. It was
when we get to roaster now?
Yeah.
Do you mind if we roast you?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to roast you. Let's see.
It was a part about the low carb, and you cited Gary Tobbs.
And you didn't cite him in the literature review. You mentioned Tobbs and Lustig, and we had dinner with Lustig once.
No, we had lunch with Lustig. That was our first obesity conference, and the guy was a nut. You could tell he's very smart, but he's a nut. And
do you know him for real or not at all?
I don't. I have talked to Dr. or not Dr. but Gary Tobbs.
Yeah, we also hung out with him.
I just say that they have brought awareness in this field.
That's okay. That's what we're all about roasting out. You got it.
we were laughing. We were like, oh, we got to give her crap about the Gary Tobbs thing.
And Lustig, do you know how he pronounces fructose?
No.
This is one of our favorites. It's fructose.
He said the word fructose.
He said that about 48 times in our lunch
at
with him.
At least
12 years ago.
At least we're moving the conversation forward. And I think it's taken a long time and we're in a different place now. But
yes, very good. All right. So where can they find your book?
So you can find us wherever books are sold, support your independent booksellers, but you can get it on Amazon too. It was released this week, and I don't have the largest platform, and I have really a Dr. Singh patience, and I'm not a whiz like you, Spencer, on social media. But
neither am I. He's the younger millennial brother. I got nothing. I'm just trying to keep up.
But what's been really amazing is that there has been just native and growth and embracing, and it's been very exciting to see this book do so well over on Amazon. So please go out, support, and really for all the doctors listening, please share this with med students and other doctors. And if you're an obesity medicine doc, give this to your colleagues who are giving you a hard time and telling your patients to kind of come off these meds inappropriately. I really hope it's just an easy to comprehend and digest book.
Yeah.
And there are lots of nice little examples in the end. You have some recipes that you throw in there, and just some other little like worksheets, almost like a little workbook at the end with the examples of things that are also helpful.
We have workbook elements throughout and QR codes to downloadables on our website, because I really want people to be able to do exactly what I do with my patients. And to do, it does take work on your own, and it takes day in and day out work. It shouldn't be hard, but it should be transformative. And so we give you those tools.
You don't have to
like go to Reddit or all over the internet and watch 30-second clips and try to piece it together yourself.
Yeah, I've been careful about that. I noted you responded to one of the videos I did these two doctors, basically stigmatizing the medicines. And it's really funny.
Oh, God, what happened?
A urologist and a gastroenterologist were just making they're like, don't get on these medicines. You become dependent on
Dr. Oh my God. I'm going to go on and I'm going to say, don't get dependent on whatever the heck medications they use for whatever they use.
Whatever they're doing.
Their erection pills. Come on. Jeez.
God. Seriously.
I prescribe those for people all the time too.
Their boner cocktails.
There's so much misinformation adds piles on to the bias and the stigma. So.
Yeah. And, and that's, I will say that's frustrating. At the beginning of the book, you talk about that. And, I can't believe it's been almost 2 years since I helped ACE publish our consensus statement on stigma and bias and whatnot.
2 years.
And we don't. Yeah, it was 2023. Amazingly. We need to continue education amongst physicians and healthcare professionals. We need to reduce bias, but God, the whole world needs to reduce the bias. That's also why, it's also interesting that you mentioned that one patient story about how not only are people dealing with the internalized weight bias and the stigma of obesity, but then they lose the weight and they're dealing with it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And they catch it both sides. It's like,
I can't win.
Not helpful, people. Let's help everybody. Let's support each other. That's much to ask.
Jeez. Thank you. Also, everybody, go out and get your Ozempic Revolution. We did actually notice. I went on Amazon. I was like, two other people named their book Ozempic Revolution. How, like,
so what is copycat, how that? They're copycats.
Did you have to get permission, by the way, from Novo or something?
No,
or is there,
no.
Is there, like,
no, right. It has to do with, like,
that's what I thought. Yeah, because that's why they can just name their book Ozempic Revolution, too.
Oh, yeah. So we got these AI copycats. So do make sure that when you go, it's Ozempic Revolution.
It's the good-looking one. The other ones look like copies.
It's spelled correctly. The other ones
they look like
copies. Oh, my God. Are they really literal AI? Oh, my God.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. AI's. So be careful. So Alexandra Soa, Ozempic Revolution, the legit one.
Skynet's becoming aware, self-aware. All right.
All right. Skynet is going to start taking the Ozempic too.
Oh my God.
Thanks for coming on. Everybody go get the book. Any other last thoughts?
No, thank you for all that you do. Thank you guys.
That was
great. Eat some protein. All right, go lift some weights.
Lift some weights.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
Thanks, guys.
All right.